hanging from a peg near the basin.
"I've got a problem with your story. No one would send a slave that was hurt as badly as you out to run a message. That's insane."
Amara flushed. He didn't exactly know. That much was true, at least. I didn't want to miss the opportunity.
"No," Bernard said. "Girl, you don't look much like most slaves I've seen. Particularly pretty young women in service to a man."
She felt her face heat still more. "What do you mean, sir?" He didn't turn toward her.
"The way you hold yourself. The way you blushed when I touched your leg."
He glanced back and said,
"Very few people disguise themselves as a slave for fear they won't be able to get back out of it again. One has to be either foolish or desperate."
"You think I'm lying to you?"
"I know you're lying," the Steadholder said, without malice. "It just remains to be seen if you're foolish or desperate. Maybe you need my help, or maybe you just need to be locked in a cellar until the authorities can collect you. I've got people to look after. I don't know you. I can't trust you." "But if this discussion," he said, "is over. Now shut your mouth before you pass out."
She felt him move closer and looked up just as he lifted her up again, keeping her unwounded arm against his chest. She didn't mean to, but she found herself laying her head against his shoulder and closing her eyes. She was just too tired, and it hurt too much. She hadn't slept since... had it been 2 days ago?
"Going to be in here fixing dinner," Bernard was saying. "So we'll move you to a cot by the fire in the great hall. Everyone will be in here tonight because of the storm."
She heard herself make a small sound of acknowledgement, but the ordeal of having her wounds cleaned, coupled with her exhaustion, left her in no condition to do more. She leaned against him and soaked in his warmth, his strength, drowsing. She didn't stir until he began lowering her onto the cot. The door to the hall opened somewhere behind him and out of her sight. Footsteps came toward them, but she couldn't see who they belonged to and couldn't work up the energy to care. Frederick's nervous voice said,
"Sir, there's some travellers asking for shelter from the storm."
"That's right, Steadholder," said Fidelius, his voice even, pleasant, using a relaxed Reven accent as though he were a native. "I hope the three of us won't be an inconvenience."
Chapter 16. Isana woke to the sounds of wind groaning over the valley and the hollow clanging of the storm chimes hanging outside. She frowned and rubbed at her eyes, struggling to orient herself. Her last memories were of being carried to her bed after tending to Bernard. She must have slept for hours. She didn't feel thirsty, which was no surprise. Rill often tended to such matters on her own initiative. But her stomach growled and roiled with an almost painful need for food, and her body ached as though she'd not moved for days. Frowning, Isana pushed aside the purely physical sensations until she reached something deeper, more detached. And once she had isolated that feeling, she focused on it, closing her eyes to shut out the miscellaneous emotional noise she always felt around her. Something was wrong. Something was very wrong. It was a quiet, nauseating feeling deep down, something that made her think of funerals and sickbeds and the smell of burnt hair. It felt familiar, and it took her a moment to track back through her memory, to realize when she had found such a sensation within her before. Isana's heart lurched in sudden panic. She threw off the covers and rose, drawing a robe on over the shift she'd slept in. Her hair hung down past her waist, loose and tangled, but she left it so. She belted the robe and stepped toward her door. Her balance swayed, and she had to lean against the door for a moment, closing her eyes until she regained her balance. She opened the door to find her brother moving quietly out of his room across the hall.
"Bernard," she cried, and went to him, gripping him in a sudden tight embrace.
He felt warm and solid and strong in her arms.
"Oh, thank all the furies. You're all right."
She lifted her eyes to his and asked, anguish making the words tight,
"Is Tavi..."
He's all right, Bernard said. A little banged up, not terribly happy, but he'll be fine.
Isana felt sudden tears blur her eyes, and she pressed her face against her brother's chest and hugged him again.
Oh, Bernard, thank you.
He hugged her back and said, voice gruff,
Nothing I did. He'd already taken care of himself and was on the way home.
What happened?
Bernard was silent for a moment, and she could feel the discomfort in him.
I'm not sure, he said finally. I remember setting out with him yesterday, but beyond that, nothing. I woke up in bed about an hour before sunrise.
Isana forced the tears back and stepped back from him, nodding.
Crafting trauma. Memory loss.
Like when Frederick broke his legs.
Bernard made a growling sound.
I don't like it. If what Tavi says is true.
She tilted her head to one side.
What does Tavi say?
She listened as Bernard recounted Tavi's story to her, and she could only shake her head.
That boy.
She closed her eyes.
I don't know whether to hug him or scream at him.
But if we were attacked by one of the Marat, sis, this could be very bad. We'd have to take word of it to Graham.
Isana bit her lip.
I think you should.
Bernard, I've got a bad feeling.
Something's wrong.
He frowned down at her.
What do you mean, wrong?
She shook her head and knew that the frustration she felt showed in her voice.
Bad.
Wrong.
I can't explain it.
She took a deep breath and told him very quietly,
I've only felt like this once before.
Bernard's face went pale. He was silent for a long minute before he said,
I don't remember any Marat, Sana. I can't take word of it to Graham. His truth finder would know.
Then Tavi will have to do it,
Isana said.
He's a child. You know how Graham is. He'll never take Tavi seriously.
Isana turned and paced a few steps back and forth.
He'll have to. We'll make him.
Bernard shook his head.
No one makes Graham do anything.
He shifted his weight a bit so that more of his body fell between Isana and the door to his room.
This isn't anything to trifle with or to let Graham's stiff neck...
Isana frowned and leaned to look past her brother. Without changing expression, he moved a bit more to block her view with his body. Isana let out an impatient breath and shouldered her brother a bit to one side, looking past him.
Bernard, she said. Why is there a girl in your bed?
Her brother coughed and flushed.
Isana, when you say it that way...
She turned to blink up at him.
Bernard, why is there a girl in your bed?
He grimaced.
That's Amara. The slave Tavi helped. I was going to lay her down on a cot by the fire, but she panicked. Begged me not to let her sleep down there, whispering like she was afraid of something. So I told her I wouldn't, and she just passed out.
He glanced back toward his room.
I brought her up here.
To your bed.
Isana! Where else was I supposed to take her?
Just tell me you don't think she's actually a lost slave who Tavi happened to rescue.
No, he said. I don't. Her story didn't add up. It sounded all right at first, but I cleaned out her cuts and didn't give her anything for the pain. She got tired fast. Nearly collapsed.
She's hurt?
Nothing to kill her. So long as she doesn't take fever, but yes. Her feet got cut up on rocks, and she's got what looks like a blade wound on her arm. Says she got them falling down.
Clumsy girl,
Isana said. She shook her head.
Sounds like she's someone. Maybe an agent of one of the lords?
Who knows? She seemed decent enough. I suppose she could be what she says.
A quiet and desperate fear curled through her. Isana felt her hands start to shake, and her knees.
And she just happened to arrive that close to him?
He sighed and shook his head.
I didn't like that part either. And there's more.
Strangers downstairs. Three of them. They're asking for shelter until the storm blows over.
And they just happened to show up today. Isana swallowed. It's happening, isn't it?
We knew it might.
She swore softly.
Furies, Bernard. Crows and bloody furies.
His voice sounded pained.
Isana.
She held up her hand toward him. No, Bernard. No. There's too much to do. How is Tavi? He pressed his lips together for a moment, but said,
Not good. I was hard on him. Guess I was upset at not knowing what was going on. Worried.
We have to find out what's going on. We must know whether or not he's in any danger.
All right. What do you want me to do?
Get downstairs to those strangers. Be polite with them. Get them some food. Get their shoes off.
Their shoes?
Isana snapped. Have someone wash their feet, city style. Just do it. She closed her eyes, thinking. I'll talk to Tavi and this Amara. Make sure they aren't hurt worse than you thought.
She's exhausted, he pointed out. Looks like she's been run into the ground.
She shouldn't be up to telling much of a lie, then, Isana said. I'll be downstairs to talk to the strangers in a bit. Do you know how the storm is shaping up? He nodded.
Not as bad as last night, but not pretty. Everyone should be all right if they're indoors, but I've called everyone into the hall just to be safe.
Good, Isana said. The more people there, the better. Don't leave them alone, Bernard. Don't let them out of your sight. All right?
I won't, he promised. What about Tavi? He should know.
She shook her head. No. Now more than ever, no. He doesn't need that on his head. Bernard looked unhappy with her words, but did not gainsay them. He turned toward the stairs, but hesitated, looking into his bedroom at the girl who lay on the bed.
Isana. The girl is barely more than a child. She's exhausted. She had a chance to do wrong, and she didn't. Tavi says she saved his life. He should let her rest.
I don't want anyone to be hurt, Isana said. Go on. His expression hardened.
I mean it.
All right. He nodded to her and vanished silently down the stairs again. Isana went back into her bedroom and took up her bone-handled brush. She took it with her, gathering her hair over one shoulder, and knocked at Tavi's door. There was no response. She knocked again and said, Tavi, it's me. May I come in? Silence. Then the doorknob turned and the door opened a fraction. She opened the door the rest of the way and walked into the room. Tavi's room was dark, with no lights lit. Of course he couldn't use the fury lamps, she reminded herself, and he'd been inside since Bernard had come home earlier that day. With the windows shuttered and the storm gathering outside, the place held a surprisingly deep collection of shadows. She could just see him settling back down onto his bed, no more than a dim outline across the room. She began to brush at her hair, giving him a chance to speak. He remained silent, and after several moments she asked, How are you feeling, Tavi?
Why don't you tell me, he said, his tone sullen. I don't know any water crafting, so how am I supposed to know?
Isana sighed. Tavi, that's not fair. You know that I don't have a choice about what I sense from others.
Plenty of things aren't fair, he shot back.
You're upset about what your uncle told you.
I worked all year to get those sheep he promised. And this...
He shook his head, his voice tightening with anguish, frustration that pressed against Isana like the heat from an old fire. You made some bad choices, Tavi. But that doesn't mean that
choices...
Tavi spat the word bitterly.
As though I ever had that many to make. It isn't like I'm going to have to worry about that again now.
She tugged the brush at a tangle in her hair. You're just upset. So was your uncle. This isn't anything to get worked up about, Tavi. I'm sure that when everyone's calmed down... The sudden surge of frustration and pain from Tavi hit her like a tangible wind. The brush tumbled from her fingers and to the floor. She caught her breath,
though the intensity of the boy's emotions nearly robbed her of balance.
"Tavi, are you all right?"
He whispered, "It's nothing to get worked up about."
"I don't understand why these sheep are so important to you."
"No," he said. "You wouldn't. I want to be by myself." Isana pressed her lips together and bent carefully to recover her brush.
"But I need to talk to you about what happened. There are some things..."
Anger. Real, vibrant rage rushed across the room along with the other sensations pouring from him. "I am finished talking about what happened," Tavi said. "I want to be alone. Please leave."
"Tavi."
His dim shape rolled over on the bed, turning his back to the door. Isana felt her own emotions begin to drift dangerously toward what the boy felt, his feelings beginning to bleed into hers. She drew a breath, steeling herself against them, and said, "All right, but we aren't through talking. Later." He didn't answer. Isana retreated from the room. She had hardly shut the door when she heard the latch slide shut on the inside and lock it closed. She had to take several steps down the hall before she emerged from the deluge of the boy's emotions. She couldn't understand it. Why was Tavi so upset over what had happened? More to the point, why didn't she know about the events of the day before? Could they have any bearing on the arrival of so many strangers to the valley at once? She shook her head and leaned against the wall for a moment. Tavi had a powerful personality, a formidable force of will that lent his passions an extra weight, somehow, and forced her to struggle more sharply to keep them separate from her own. Not that it was surprising that she should feel him more keenly than anyone else, in any case. She loved him too much, had been near him too long. To say nothing of the other reasons. Isana shook her head firmly. Regardless of how drained she felt from last night's crafting, there was no time to waste. She should have remembered her purpose when speaking to the boy, to learn what she could of the previous day's events that Bernard could not remember. She turned toward her brother's room and took a deep breath. Then she paced inside, determined. Bernard had left the lamp burning on a low flame, and the room's interior was lit by soft golden light. Bernard lived simply. He had, ever since Cassia and the girls had died. He had removed all of her things, packing them in a pair of trunks stowed underneath his bed. He lived out of a single trunk now, as he had in the legions. His weapons and gear were stowed on racks on one wall across from the bare writing desk, all the records for the Steadhold stowed neatly in its drawers. The girl slept in Bernard's bed. She was tall, with lean features that seemed particularly drawn in the light, dark circles like bruises beneath her eyes. Her skin glowed golden, almost the same shade as her hair. She was beautiful. A braid of leather circled her throat. Isana frowned at her. Her brother had gotten down the extra blankets and piled them over the girl, though she had evidently stirred enough that her feet had slipped from beneath them. Isana stepped forward absently to cover her feet again and saw that they had been bandaged and covered in slippers of soft calfskin. Isana stared down at the slippers for a moment. Pale white, stitched neatly, with delicate beadwork tracing a design over the tops. She recognized it at once. She had done it herself, perhaps 10 years before. The slippers had been a birthday gift for Cassia. They had been in the chest beneath the bed for more than a decade. Isana stepped back from the bed. She wanted to speak to the girl, but her brother had warned her against disturbing her. She had hoped for years that he would find someone else after he'd lost Cassia and the girls, but he never had. Bernard had continually kept a quiet distance between himself and anyone else, and those who lived in the valley, those who remembered his wife and daughters, had simply given him the solitude he wished. If her brother had found it in himself again to reach out to someone else, and from his words to her and the way he had treated the girl it seemed that he had, could she so readily act against him? Isana stepped forward and laid her hand across the girl's forehead. Even before she had reached out through Rill, she felt the mild fever in her. She shivered and slowly extended her senses out through the fury and into the sleeping slave. Bernard had not been mistaken. The girl bore several injuries, from painful cuts upon her legs to a painfully swollen ankle to a sharp, vicious cut along her upper arm. Her body had been pushed to exhaustion, and even in sleep, Isana could feel that the girl was gripped by a terrible worry and fear. She murmured softly to Rill, and felt the fury course gently through the girl, mending closed the smaller cuts and easing the swelling and pain. The effort left Isana's head light, and she drew her hand back and concentrated on remaining on her feet. When she looked down again, the girl had opened her exhausted eyes and was staring up at her.
"You,"
she whispered.
"You're the water crafter that healed the steadholder."
Isana nodded and said,
"You should rest. I just want to ask you one question."
The girl swallowed and nodded. She let her eyes fall closed.
"Have you come for the boy?" Isana asked. "Are you here to take him?"
"No,"
the girl said, and Isana felt the simple truth in her words as clearly as the tone of a silver bell. There was a purity to the way she spoke, a sense of sincerity that reassured Isana, let her shoulders unknot, if only a little.
"All right," Isana said.
She adjusted the blankets over the girl, covering her feet once more.
"Sleep. I'll bring you some food in a little while."
The girl did not reply, motionless on the bed, and Isana withdrew from the room to the top of the stairs. She could hear voices below as the hold folk gathered into the hall. Outside, thunder rumbled, low and ominous from the north. The events of the night before, the cord holder's attack on her, came rushing back in memory, and she shivered. Then she straightened and walked down the stairs to deal with the other strangers who had come to Bernard Holt. Chapter 17 Fidelius waited until the big steadholder had padded up the stairs and was out of his sight, carrying someone wrapped in a blanket. The former curser glanced around the hall. For the moment at least, he and his companions had been left alone. He turned to Odiana and Aldrich with a frown. Aldrich stood staring after the steadholder and murmured,
"Well, I wonder what that was all about."
"Fairly obvious," Fidelius said. He glanced at Odiana.
"Fear,"
she whispered, and shivered as she leaned closer to Aldrich.
"The most delicious fear. Recognition."
"Amara," Fidelius nodded. "She's here. That was her."
Aldrich lifted his eyebrows.
"But he never turned around. You never saw her face."
Fidelius gave Aldrich an even look and suppressed a surge of irritation.
"Aldrich, please. Do you expect her to hang a sign on the door that she's here? It all fits. Three sets of tracks. The boy's, the steadholder's, and hers. She was limping. That's why he was carrying her."
Aldrich sighed.
"All right, then. I'll go up and kill those two, and we can be about it."
He turned away and lifted a hand to his sword.
"Aldrich!"
Fidelius hissed. He seized the swordsman's arm at the biceps and reached down into the earth to borrow from his fury's strength. He stopped the larger man cold. Aldrich glanced down at Fidelius's arm and relaxed.
"That was the point, wasn't it?"
the swordsman said.
"Fidelius, we have to stop them from reporting to Graham. Without the element of surprise, this entire campaign could be for nothing. We came here to find the steadholder and the boy who had seen our friend Atzerak and kill them. Oh, and the agent of the Crow's Eaten Crown, if we happen to run across her, which we have."
"Love,"
Odiana said.
"We still don't know where this boy is, do we? If you go and kill the ugly little girl right now, won't the steadholder object? And then you'd have to kill him as well, and anyone else upstairs. And all these people here."
She licked her lips, her eyes bright, and said to Fidelius,
"Why shouldn't we do this again?"
"Remember where you are," Fidelius said.
This is the most dangerous area of the realm. Powerful furies. Dangerous beasts. This isn't one of the old plantations of the Amaranth Vale. It breeds strong crafters. Did you see the way that boy handled those gargants out front? And he calmed our mounts when they got nervous. That wasn't me. And he did it without so much as stopping to make an effort. A boy. Think about it.
Aldric shrugged.
They don't go armed. They're steadholders, not warriors. We could kill them all.
Probably, Fidelius said. But what if that retired legionnaire steadholder is a strong crafter to boot? What if some of the other holders here are that strong? Odds are some of them would escape. And since we don't know who the boy we're looking for is, we'd never know if we got him.
What about that boy out front? Odiana asked. That lovely, strong, tall one with the gargants.
His feet are too big, Fidelius said. The rain all but obliterated the tracks. But the ones from earlier today are clearer. We're looking for a smallish boy, not growing a beard yet, or possibly a girl. Atzerak probably wouldn't know the difference at that age, if a girl had been wearing breeches. The Marat don't make the same distinctions we do.
He had big hands, too,
Odiana mused, and leaned against Aldric, her eyes heavy, drowsy.
May I have him, love?
Aldric leaned down and absently kissed her hair.
You'd only kill him, and then he'd be no good to you.
Get the idea out of your heads, Fidelius said, his tone firm. We have an objective. Find the boy. The storm is rolling in behind us, and everyone will be gathering into the hall. As soon as we find him, we'll take him, the steadholder, and the cursor, and leave.
Aldric grunted assent.
And what if we don't? What if he's already gone off to garrison to warn the local count?
Fidelius grimaced and looked around.
I grew up on a steadhold, and you'd never keep something like that a secret. If that's what has happened, we'll hear about it when everyone gathers in.
But what if we've borrowed trouble enough?
Fidelius sighed. He shook his head and slapped Aldric's arm gently, releasing him.
If the boy has already left, the storm will be as dangerous to him as anyone. We'll catch him, and the result will be the same.
His eyes glittered.
But Aldric, why don't you take Odiana out to make sure the horses are all right? I'll handle things in here. And if there's killing to be done, I'll let you know who and where.
Aldric frowned down at him.
You're sure about this? In here, by yourself? What if you need help?
I won't, Fidelius assured him. Go on to the stables. Make it clear that you're looking for a bit of privacy. I'm sure they'll let a couple of newlywed travellers have it.
Aldric arched his brows.
Newlywed?
The Water Witch's eyes smoldered. Odiana flashed a smile to Fidelius, then turned to Aldric with a sway of her hips and took one of his hands in hers. She kissed his fingers as she walked backward toward the doors to the hall.
I'll explain it to you, love. Let's go find the stables. There will be hay there. Would you like to see the hay in my hair?
Aldric's eyes narrowed, and he let out a low and not unpleased sound.
Ah.
He started out, keeping hold of Odiana's hands.
I knew there was a reason I liked working with you, old man.
Just be listening, Fidelius warned quietly.
The witch nodded and replied,
Keep a cup in your hands, and drink in the cup. I'll hear.
Then she and the swordsman vanished toward the stone stables. No sooner had they left than Fidelius heard a heavy tread on the stairs leading down into the hall, and the steadholder appeared again, his face set in something between a frown and a scowl. He looked around and said,
Sorry about that. Just had to take care of someone hurt.
Ah,
said Fidelius, studying the man. He stepped with the faintest trace of hesitation on his left side, as though it pained him slightly to do so. If he had been wounded, as Atzerak had indicated, then the wound had been crafted shut, which meant that a reasonably powerful watercrafter resided in the Steadholt as well.
"Nothing too bad, I hope."
The man shook his head and said,
"Nothing we can't handle."
He extended a hand to several seats by the fire.
"Sit down, sit down. Let me get you a cup of something hot."
Fidelius murmured a thanks and settled down by the fire with the large man.
"Steadholder Bernard, I assume?"
"Just Bernard, sir."
"Please, just Del."
The Steadholder half smiled.
"Del. So what brings you out to garrison this late in the year, Del?"
"Business," Fidelius replied. "I represent a group of investors who fronted several prospectors money to locate gems in the wilderness over the summer. They should be coming back in with the weather turning worse, and we'll see what they found."
Bernard nodded.
"I thought you had a couple more with you. Where did your friends go?"
Fidelius gave him a warm grin and a wink.
"Ah, yes. My guardsman is a newlywed, and I let him bring his wife with him. They went out to check on the horses."
The Steadholder gave Fidelius a polite smile.
"To be young again, eh?"
Fidelius agreed.
"My days of creeping off to stables with blushing maids are long past.
The storm's coming in. I want to have everyone here in the hall just to be safe."
Fidelius nodded.
"I'm sure they'll be along in a little while."
The Steadholder nodded.
"See to it that they are. I'll have no one harmed while under my roof."
Fidelius detected a slight edge to the words, one the Steadholder himself probably wasn't aware of. His instincts twinged, a low and subtle alarm lending an edge of tension to him, but he nodded and smiled and said,
"Of course."
"If you'll excuse me, then. I need to make the rounds and make sure everything's secured before the storm comes down."
"Of course. Again, thank you for your hospitality. If I can be of any assistance to you, let me know."
Bernard grunted and rose, his expression preoccupied. Fidelius watched the man carefully, but could read little of him through his body language. Tense, to be sure. But wouldn't any Steadholder be, when facing a threat to his holders? He carried his legs stiffly still as he moved out of the hall and into the courtyard. And just before he left, the big man glanced over his shoulder toward a staircase in the far corner of the hall. Fidelius watched him and waited until the Steadholder had left the hall to glance at the staircase himself. Interesting. A moment later, a pretty young girl brought a steaming mug out to Fidelius's seat by the fire, presenting it to him with a slight curtsy. "Sir." He smiled at her and accepted the mug.
"Thank you, young lady, but please, call me Del."
She smiled at him, a winsome expression.
"My name is Berita, sir. Del."
"A lovely name for a lovely girl."
He sipped at the drink, a tea he vaguely recognized.
"Wonderful. I suppose you've had an interesting few days here with the storm and all that's happened."
She nodded, folding her hands in front of her and inhaling just enough to let her bodice round out her young breasts.
"Between all the excitement yesterday and then last night, it's been one thing after another. Though I suppose it isn't anything compared to the life of a gem merchant, sir."
His eyebrows lifted, and he said, letting a small smile touch his mouth,
"I don't remember mentioning that to you, Berita. I thought I was alone with the Steadholder."
Her cheeks colored bright scarlet.
"Oh, sir, I'm sorry. I've a little wind crafting, you see, and..."
"And you listened in," he suggested.
"We so seldom have visitors to Bernard Holt, sir," the girl said.
She looked up, her eyes direct.
"I'm ever so interested in new, exciting people."
"Who are wealthy gem merchants," Fidelius thought wryly. "Completely understandable, though honestly, from the things I've heard..."
He leaned closer to her, looking left and right.
"Was the Steadholder really hurt yesterday?"
The girl knelt down beside the chair, leaning toward him just enough to let him see the curve of her bosom should he look down.
Yes, and it was terrible. He was so pale that when Fades are idiots, sir, the poor man, first dragged him in here, I thought the steadholder was dead. And then Cord and his sons went mad, and the steadholders all set to fighting one another with their furies.
Her eyes gleamed.
I've never seen anything like it. Perhaps later, after dinner, he'd like to hear more about it.
Fidelius nodded, meeting her eyes.
That sounds very exciting, Baritta. And the boy? Was he hurt as well?
The girl blinked at him for a moment, expression confused, and then asked blankly,
Tavi, sir? Is that who you mean?
I'd only heard there was a boy hurt as well.
Oh, I suppose you mean Tavi then, but he's no one. And even though he's the steadholder's nephew, we don't really like to talk about him very much, sir. He and Simple Fade.
The boy's an idiot as well?
Oh, he's clever enough, I suppose. Just as Fade is handy enough with a smith's hammer. But he's never going to be much more than Fade is.
She leaned closer to him so that her breasts pressed against his arm and whispered importantly,
He's furyless, sir.
Entirely?
Fidelius tilted his head, holding his cup where he could be sure his voice would strike the drink within it squarely.
I've never heard of such a thing. Do you think I could meet him?
Baritta shrugged.
If you really want to. He went up to his room when the steadholder brought him and that slave home. I suppose he'll be down for dinner.
Fidelius nodded toward the stairs the steadholder had glanced at.
Upstairs there? Do you know if the slave is up there as well?
Baritta frowned at him.
I suppose. They'll be down for dinner, I expect. I'm cooking tonight, and I'm a very good cook, sir. I'd love to hear what you think of...
A new voice interrupted the girl, confident and smooth. Baritta, that will be quite enough from you. You've chores in the kitchen. Attend to them. The girl flushed an angry and embarrassed pink, rose to give Fidelius a swift curtsy, and then fled the hall, back toward the kitchens. Fidelius lifted his eyes to see a tall, girlish figure wearing a dressing gown. Long, dark hair spilled over her shoulders down to her waist. Her face was youthful, with a pleasingly full mouth. She carried herself with quiet confidence, and he noted the threads of silver in her hair. This would be the watercrafter, then. At once Fidelius drew in his emotions, carefully controlling them, veiling them from her perceptions, even as he rose to bow to her.
Lady Steadholder.
She regarded him with a cool expression, her own features every bit as masked as he knew his own were.
I am the Steadholder's sister, Isana.
Welcome to Bernard Holt, sir. A pleasure. I hope I did not steal away the girl for too long.
As do I, Isana said. She has a tendency to talk when she should listen.
There are many like her across the realm, he murmured.
May I inquire as to your business in Bernard Holt, sir?
The question was innocuous enough, but Fidelius sensed the trap in it. He kept a tight rein on his feelings and said blithely,
We seek shelter from the coming storm, lady, and are passing through on our way to garrison.
I see. She glanced after the girl and said, I hope you have no plans to make away with any of our young people, sir.
Fidelius let out a low laugh.
Naturally not, lady.
Her eyes moved back to his and remained there, steady, for several long beats. He regarded her in reply with a blank, pleasant smile.
But where are my manners? The woman said.
A moment, sir.
She crossed to the fire and took from a shelf near it a pan, some clean cloths. She filled the pan from the pipe that passed through the rear of the fireplace, the water steaming, and moved back to him. She knelt in front of him, setting the pan aside, and began unlacing his boots. Fidelius frowned. Though the gesture would have been common enough in a city, it was rarely observed in the Steadholts, particularly those this far from civilization.
"Really, lady, this isn't necessary."
She looked up at him, and he thought he caught a glimmer of triumph in her eyes. "Oh, but it is. I insist, sir. It is to our very great honour that we treat our guests with courtesy and hospitality."
"You're already doing enough," he said.
She tugged his boot off and tossed it to one side. The other soon joined it. "Nonsense. My brother would be horrified if I did not treat you with all the honour you deserve."
Fidelius settled back with his tea, frowning, but unable to voice any particular protest against the ritual. As she washed his feet, people began to trickle into the hall by threes and fours and fives, families mostly, he noted. The Steadholt was a prosperous one. Though the seats around the fire were given a respectful space, the rest of the large hall was soon filled with motion and sound and quietly festive talk, the mark of a folk who knew that they were safe, while outside the thunder rolled, the wind was rising, and the storm chimes were clanging away in steady rhythm. Isana finished and said, "I'll just have these brushed clean, sir, and send them right back to you." She rose, taking his boots in hand. "I'm afraid we can offer only clean blankets and a place beside the fire this night. We'll have our dinner together and then turn in for the night."
Fidelius glanced at the stairs and then back to the watercrafter. Simple enough, then. Once everyone was sleeping, even the suspicious watercrafter, it would be an easy enough matter to slit three throats in the darkness and slip away before morning light.
"Everyone together at dinner," he smiled at her and said. "That sounds per—"
The doors to the hall abruptly slammed open, and Aldrich stormed in, letting in the howling wind. Rain and sleet pounded down around his broad shoulders and across the threshold with him. Odiana clung to his side. Both looked disheveled, straw littering their hair and clothing. Aldrich cut through the crowded hall and came straight to Fidelius, the holders scattering out of his way, like sheep before a running horse.
"Fidelius," Aldrich breathed, keeping his voice low. "Someone has let our horses out. They know."
Fidelius let out a curse and looked toward the watercrafter, only to see her holding her skirts with one hand while she dashed up the far staircase, his boots in her other.
"Bloody crows," he breathed, rising, feet cold upon the floor. "I'll get the horses and the steadholder. The boy and Amara are up those stairs."
He turned to Aldrich, feeling for the knife hidden in his tunic, and said,
"Kill them."
Chapter 18. Tarvi eventually came to the conclusion that he was sulking. It wasn't easily reached, of course. It took nearly 10 minutes of staring at the wall in smouldering anger after his aunt's departure before it occurred to Tarvi that she did not look at all well. That in turn led to worrying about her, and after that it became impossible to sustain a good sullen rage. The anger slowly faded, and left him feeling tired, sore, and hungry. Tarvi sat up on his bed and swung his legs over the side. He kicked his feet, frowning, while he thought about the events of the past day and what they meant to him. He had neglected his responsibilities and told a lie, and now he suffered for it, and so did the people who cared about him. His uncle had been wounded badly in his defense, and now Aunt Isana looked as though the efforts of healing his uncle's leg had damaged her health. Such things were not unheard of. And even though Bernard tried to hide it, his uncle walked with a very slight limp. It was just possible that he would keep it, but the injury had done permanent damage to his leg. Tarvi rested his chin in his hands and closed his eyes, feeling foolish, selfish, childish. He had been so focused on getting the sheep, his sheep, back, on keeping his uncle's respect, that he had forgotten to behave in a manner that was worthy of it. He had exposed himself and others to great risk, all for the sake of his dream, the Academy. If he had gotten to the Academy as a result of his ill-considered choices, would it have been worth it? Could he really have made a better life for himself, knowing what he had traded away to get it?
"You are an idiot, Tarvi," he mumbled to himself. "A true shining example of idiocy."
Matters could be much worse for him, much worse for his family as well.
He shuddered at the thought of his uncle dead on the ground, or his aunt lying beside a healing tub with her eyes empty, her body still breathing but already dead. Though things had not played out the way he had wished them to, they could have been more disastrous. Though he ached in every muscle and his head felt light and feverish, he went to the door. He would find his aunt and uncle, apologize to them, and offer to make amends. He had no idea what he would do, but he knew that he had to at least try. They deserved that much. He had to earn the respect he wanted, not through daring or cleverness, but simply through hard work and reliability, just as his uncle and aunt had. Tavi was about to open the door when there came a swift, soft rapping at his window. He blinked, looking back across the dimness of his room. Outside, the wind was rising and he had already put up the storm shutters. Perhaps one of the more mischievous wind furies had rattled the shutters. The knock came again. Three quick knocks, too slow. Three quick, too slow. Tavi went to the window and unfastened the latch to the storm shutters. They sprang open, all but knocking him down, and let in a torrent of cold, misty wind. Tavi drew back several steps as someone slipped into the room, lithe and nearly silent. Amara made a soft, quiet sound and slipped entirely into the room, then turned and shut the window and the shutters behind her. She was wearing what looked like a pair of his uncle's trousers, belted about her slender waist with a heavy leather cord. His tunic and shirt billowed on her, as did the heavily padded jacket and cloak, but she had secured them with more strips of leather, so that she was quite evidently functional in them. She wore pale slippers on her feet, and what looked like several layers of socks under them. In one hand she held a bundle that included an old leather pack of Bernard's, his hunting bow, a handful of arrows, and the sword they'd recovered from the princeps memoriam. "Tavi," she said, "get dressed in warm clothes. Bring extra socks, some blankets, food, if you have any up here. We're leaving."
"Leaving?" Tavi stammered.
"Keep your voice down," the slave hissed. Tavi blinked and mumbled, "Sorry." "Don't apologize. Hurry. We don't have much time."
"We can't leave," Tavi protested. "The storm's coming in."
"It won't be as bad as the last one," Amara said. "And we can take more salt with us. You have a smokehouse here, yes? Salt for the meat?"
"Of course, but..."
Amara crossed to his trunk, swung the first open and started digging.
"Hey!"
Tavi protested. She threw a pair of heavy trousers into his face, followed by three of his thickest shirts. She followed that with his jacket from its peg on the wall and then his second-best cloak. "Get those on," Amara said.
"No," Tavi said firmly. "I'm not leaving. I just got back. People got hurt trying to come and find me. I'm not going to make them go through that again. You can't expect me to put the people of my own steadhold in danger so that I can go running off with a fugitive slave."
Amara went to the door and checked the latch, making sure it was shut. "Tavi, we don't have time. If you want to live, come with me. Right now." Tavi blinked at her, so startled that he dropped the clothes he had been holding.
"What?"
"If you don't leave with me right now, you aren't going to live through the night."
"What are you talking about?"
"Get dressed," she said.
"No,"
he snapped. "Not until I know what's happening." Her eyes narrowed, and for the first time he'd been near her, Tavi felt a sliver of fear quiver through him. "Tavi, if you don't get dressed and come with me, I will knock you out, wrap you in a blanket, and take you with me." Tavi licked his lips.
"No, you won't," he said. "You couldn't carry me down through the hall, and you won't be able to carry me out the window either. Or on the ground. Not with your ankle hurt."
Amara blinked at him and then ground her teeth. "Too clever," she muttered. "This Steadholt, maybe everyone in the valley, is in danger. I think you and I can help them. Tavi, get dressed. Please. I'll explain while you do." Tavi swallowed, staring at the young woman. The Steadholt in danger? What was she talking about? The last thing he needed was to go chasing off again, to prove to everyone who mattered that he couldn't be trusted. But Amara had saved his life, and if she was telling the truth...
"All right, talk."
He stooped down to recover his clothes and started shrugging into the shirts.
Amara nodded and came closer, holding the clothes for him, helping him into them. First of all, I'm not a slave. I'm a cursor, and I've been sent to this valley at the command of the First Lord himself. Tavi blinked up at her and then stuffed his arms into the sleeves.
To deliver mail?
Amara sighed. No. That's just one of the things we do, Tavi. I am the agent of the First Lord. He thinks this valley may be in danger, and he sent me to do something about it.
But you're a girl.
She frowned at him and jerked the next shirt down over his ears roughly. I'm a cursor, and I think the First Lord is right.
But what does this have to do with me? With Bernard Holt?
You've seen the danger, Tavi. I need to take you to Garrison. You have to tell the Count there what you saw. A cold feeling chilled Tavi, and he blinked up at her.
The Marat, he breathed. The Marat are coming, aren't they? Like when they killed the Princeps.
I think so, Amara said.
My uncle saw them. He's the one that should go. The Count would never believe that he can't, Amara said.
Crafting trauma when he was healed. He doesn't remember any of it.
How do you know that? Tavi demanded.
Because I listened. I faked passing out, and I listened in on all the talk up here. Your uncle doesn't remember, and your aunt is suspicious of me. There's no time to explain it to them. We have to leave here, and right now.
Tavi tugged the heavy tunic on over the shirts, his hands moving more slowly now. Why?
Because downstairs are some men who are here to kill you, me, and anyone who has seen the Marat.
But why would another Alaran do that?
We really don't have time for that. They're the enemy. They want to unseat the First Lord, and they want the Marat to wipe out the Steadholts in the valley so that the realm perceives the First Lord as weak and ineffective.
Tavi stared at her. Wipe out the valley? But that would mean...
She regarded him, her face drawn. Unless we take warning to the Count, unless the forces at Garrison are ready to meet them, the Marat will kill everyone. This Steadholt and all the rest as well.
Crows, Tavi whispered. Oh, crows and furies.
You're the only one who has seen them, the only one who I can use to convince the Count to rouse Garrison. Amara stalked back over to the window, opened it again, then turned to Tavi and extended her hand. Are you with me? They used a sheet from Tavi's bed, tied to its leg, to drop from his window to the courtyard below. The wind whistled from the north, bringing with it the stinging chill of true winter. Amara went down first, then beckoned to Tavi, who tossed down a bundle thrown hurriedly together into the blankets from his bed. Amara caught it, and then the boy swallowed and slithered down the sheet to the stones of the courtyard. Amara led them across the courtyard in silence. No one was in evidence, though the light and noise from the hall could be heard through its thick doors. The gate door was open, and they slid through it and out into the outbuildings. Full dark was getting close, and shadows lay dim and thick over the cold ground. Tavi led them past the stables and over to the smokehouse. The building shared a wall with the smithy, where both could use the same chimney for a fire. The sharp smell of smoke and meat hung around the smokehouse in a permanent cloud.
Get the salt, Amara murmured to him.
Just take the sack if there's one at hand, or a bucket. I'll keep watch here, and hurry. Tavi slipped inside where the fading twilight held little sway, and fumbled through the dark to the shelf at the back of the smoke room. He stopped to take down a pair of hams that had been hanging, and dropped them into his makeshift bag. The salt, all rough crystals, filled a large homespun sack. Tavi tried to lift it and grunted with effort. Then he put it back down, took one of his blankets, and tore off a couple of large sections. He piled heavy salt crystals into them and twisted them shut, tying them with several lengths of leather cord kept on hand for hanging the meats. He had just picked them up and was heading back for the door when he heard a squealing sound outside the smokehouse. There was a hiss of breath and a pair of heavy thumps. Tavi hurried outside, his eyes wide, his heart pounding in his chest. There, Amara knelt with one knee on the chest of a fallen man, a knife gripped in her hand and pressed to his throat.
Stop! Tavi hissed. Get off of him!
He snuck up on me, Amara said. She didn't move the knife.
That's Fade. He's no danger to anyone.
He wouldn't answer me.
You scared him, Tavi said, and shoved at her shoulder. Amara shot him a look, but didn't fall. She took the knife from Fade's throat and rose back and away from the fallen slave. Tavi leaned down and took Fade's hand, hauling the man to his feet. He wore heavy clothes against the gathering cold, including a woolen cap with flaps that hung down to his shoulders and dangled like the ears of a gangly puppy, and second-hand gloves missing several fingers. The whole side of the slave's face was slack with fear, and he stared at Amara with wide eyes, backing up from her until his shoulders touched Tavi's chest.
Tavi, Fade said. Tavi, inside, storm coming.
I know, Fade, Tavi said. But we have to go.
There's no time for this, Amara said, shooting a glance behind her. If one of them sees us...
Tavi, stay,
Fade insisted.
I can't. Me and Amara have to get to Count Graham and warn him that the Maratha are coming. She's a curser, and we have to go before some bad men try to stop us.
Fade turned to blink his head slowly at Tavi. His face twisted in confusion, and he asked,
Tavi going? Tonight?
Yes, I have salt.
Amara hissed,
Let's go then, no time.
Fade frowned, almost scowled.
Fade too.
No, Fade, Tavi said. You have to stay here.
Going.
We have to travel light, Amara said. The slave stays.
Fade threw back his head and let out a howl like a wounded dog. Tavi choked and lurched toward the man, covering his mouth with one hand.
Quiet! Fade, they'll hear us.
Fade ceased howling, but looked at Tavi, his expression steady. Tavi looked from Fade to Amara. The cursor rolled her eyes and gestured at him to hurry. Tavi grimaced.
All right. You can go. But we have to leave right now.
Fade's mouth broke into a witless smile behind Tavi's hand, and he started chortling. He held up a hand to them, dashed inside the smithy, and emerged a few heartbeats later, bearing a battered old rucksack on his back, and muttering excited nonsense phrases to himself. Amara shook her head and asked Tavi,
He's an idiot?
He's a good man, Tavi said defensively. He's strong and he works hard. He won't get in the way.
He'd better not, Amara said.
She slipped the knife away into her belt and threw her bundle at Fade.
I'm hurt, he's not. He carries mine.
Fade dropped it and scraped a bow to Amara as he picked up the bundle of blankets and appropriated gear. He lifted that one to his other shoulder. Amara turned to lead them away from Bernard Holt, but Tavi put his hand on her shoulder.
These men, won't they catch us if we're on foot? I'm not good with horses. You're no earthcrafter. Is the slave?
Tavi glanced at Fade and grimaced.
No. I mean, he knows a little metal, and he makes shoes for the horses, but I don't think that he's an earthcrafter.
Better we walk, then, she said. One of the men after us is, and he can make the horses do what he wants to.
On horseback, they'll be faster.
That's why we'd better get going. Hopefully they'll be here until morning.
Meet me at the stable, Tavi said, and hurried off toward it in the growing dark.
Amara hissed at him, but Tavi ignored her, moving to the stable doors and inside. He was familiar with the animals of Bernard Holt. The sheep milled sleepily in their pen, and the cattle took up the rest of the room on the same side. On the other, the hulking gargants lay blowing lustily in their sleep in their burrow, and behind them Tavi heard the noise of restless, nervous horses. He slipped silently down through the stable before he heard a sound in the loft, above him, the storage space between the rafters and the peak of the roof. He froze in place, listening. A tinny voice said from the loft,
Between all the excitement yesterday and then last night, it's been one thing after another. Though I suppose it isn't anything compared to the life of a gem merchant, sir.
Tavi blinked. The voice was Beritta's, but it came as though through a long pipe, distant and blurred. It took him a moment to realize that it sounded the same as when his aunt spoke to him through Rill.
A woman's voice, strange to Tavi and near to hand, murmured with a sort of languid laziness.
There you see, love. He has a drink now and we're able to pay attention. Sometimes it's nice to hurry.
A strange man's voice answered.